on my 2023 vision board, there's only one thing that I wrote down at the beginning of this year that I haven't checked off yet, but I'm on track to do it. And when I wrote those things down, I thought they were impossible because they were, it was income that was four or five times what I'd earned the previous year. It was health goals that seemed unattainable. It was unreal, but it's happened. And it just, I look at it every morning and I go to work trying to make it happen. You can change your life in a very short amount of time.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots. I'm your host, Tate Duryea, joined by my wonderful co-host, Ryan Gibson, or at least I was until a few minutes ago. Ryan had to jump off because we went a little long on this episode, and I think you'll see why. Alan Underwood was an absolute pleasure to speak with. He is an incredibly successful entrepreneur. He's built businesses in restaurants, the automotive industry, the insurance industry, and now in real estate. And after having an incredible story about burnout and sort of rebirth into this new world of learning how to make income passively and make your money work for you rather than working really hard for your money, he explains and expounds on his incredible journey to sort of enlightenment now and all the ways that he's able to give back through things like Angel Flight West. So without further ado, let's get into the show. I think everybody's going to really enjoy this one.
Alan, thanks so much for being on the show.
Tate, Ryan, it's great to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Ryan, you want to kick us off here?
Yeah, Alan, thanks for coming on the show. I know that you've done some work, I guess, in California on ADUs and some other development stuff. And, you know, before we get started, why don't you just tell us about your kind of journey to the buzzword that we all like, which is, you know, getting that financial freedom to kind of allow you to free up your time and focus on real estate.
Well, I'd love to say that I've already crossed home plate and that I'm already there and enjoying financial freedom. That's still a journey for me, but I'm a little bit further along now than maybe I was a few years ago. Really, to dig into that, I have to back up a little bit. So my background, my grandfather was a master sergeant in the Air Force. My dad was a career employee who managed car dealerships. And the lessons that they taught me about financial success were show up early, stay late, outwork everyone else, and you'll be successful. And so for the first, yes, 20 years of my career, first 40 years of my life, that's exactly what I did. I did it as an entrepreneur. I opened a chain of restaurants when I was 21 years old. Opened one, grew it into a chain, sold those, then got into the car business, figured out there that I didn't like being an employee. So I learned the business and then opened my own car dealership. And my timing was super awesome with that because I opened in May of 2007. So I timed that perfectly for the greatest financial collapse in modern history. And didn't think we were going to survive that. We did. We ended up growing that business $1 million a year, every year for the next 13 years. And then 2018, found out that my mother-in-law had cancer. She passed away a week later. 2019, my father-in-law passed away from cancer. 2020, my dad had a massive stroke and passed away. And I, in the middle of that grief, woke up and looked around and realized, and my dad was 66. At the time, I was 43. And I went, whoa, what if there's only 23 more summer vacations or 23 more Christmases with my kids? I've missed the majority of the first part of their life growing these businesses, and we'd enjoyed tremendous success, but I had grown myself a great job. My grandpa, my dad, nobody taught me how to invest in real estate. And it was really a moment where I just kind of realized I had been doing great things, but the life that I'd set up for myself was not the life that I wanted for the next 20 years. So I had no idea even where to start. So I started going to real estate meetups. I was fortunate in the fact that I bought a piece of property, a commercial property, where I thought I was going to build a dealership. And when I went in to work with an attorney to get that, to see what was possible there by way of a car dealership or a strip mall or something commercial, he looked at me and said, "Alan, you don't want to do a strip mall here, a car dealership." And I said, "No, that's exactly what I want to do. That's why I'm here to talk to you." And he said, "Well, 99% of the people that I'm working with in Arizona are looking for the zoning that you have to do multifamily development. What do you know about multifamily?" And I didn't even know what the word meant at the time. I had no clue what he was talking about. And he said, "Well, you know, why don't you go talk to this developer?" So I met with a guy named Dave. Dave, in about 30 seconds, drew on the back of a napkin exactly what he would do with that piece of property. I said, "Oh, you can do about 90 units here." And so that started my education into what real estate was. I started flipping houses. I joined several different networking groups until I found one that I thought was a really good fit. I learned about funds and syndications and then started one. It's been 3 years of just constant education. I don't have a huge portfolio of real estate right now. And I kind of started at the top end. I started with a 90 plus unit apartment complex development in Mesa on accident. That turned into putting together a fund. And now we're, you know, the goal is $200 million of property in San Diego over the next 5 years. So I don't know where you guys want to go from that. There's a lot in that story that is unbelievable to me most of the time.
Yeah, I've got some threads. so, you know, really compelling story. Thank you for sharing, by the way. You know, difficult time in your life, you know, with your family passing away like that. I can see how that really gets you thinking about, what do I do? I've only got so much time. I think it's called 18 Summers, is like a book or something like that. And I constantly think about that and the limited time we have with our kids before they are going to move out of the house and not want to talk to us for a few years. And then maybe they come back around when they're in their 20s. You know, as having two young kids, I think about that often, actually, and make sure that I balance my time. But what made you kind of spark the real estate part of that? I mean, what helped you bridge the gap between I'm trading time for money to having basically real estate work hard for you and provide you with income?
I think there were a couple of key moments there. One of them was when I was meeting with Dave and talking about the potential of this property. He offered to purchase the property from me for twice what I'd paid for it because of the real estate potential there, the development potential. I asked what he would do with it. He told me he would entitle it and then he would sell it. I asked, you know, he said it would cost about $500,000 to get the entitlements done and a couple of years worth of work, but then he would be able to realize a profit of 2 or 3 times what he paid for the property. And so that was one thing. The other thing was I had been gone from home so much that I wanted to do something where I could be based from home. And real estate seemed like something, while it would require some effort in the beginning, that a lot of the work that I could do from home and be more present with my family. And then as I put myself into rooms with people who were doing or had been doing a lot more real estate than I had, I could see that in the same 20-year period where they had dedicated themselves to building a portfolio of passive income producing real estate properties or flipping homes or whatever their dedication into real estate was, that they had put themselves in a position in that 20 years where now they were financially free. Not only they could work from home or anywhere else in the world they wanted to, because it didn't matter. They had money coming in. And I envied that. I wanted to be able to choose if I went to work or didn't go to work. And I think a lot of people are in that position, whether you like your job or you don't like your job. fortunately was in a position that I developed a great business and had enough resources where I could turn those resources around and put them into real estate. And so now my real focus is, in fact, if I turn the camera and look at my vision board, one of the things on my vision board for the next couple of years is helping my kids start their real estate investing. And they're, you know, the oldest one is in her early 20s. I don't want to repeat the same pattern. I'm not teaching them show up early and stay late and outwork everybody else. I'm teaching them, let's figure out how to house hack. Come with me and see what I'm doing in San Diego, and let's see how you can participate in that. I have a son-in-law who's in the military who has a VA loan that we'll be able to leverage, and connecting him with other guys in the military that have already done that. So a lot of checkpoints along the way, but it really was getting into rooms with people who were already doing it. And then I didn't have to figure it out. I just had to look and see, okay, that's what you're doing. I'm smart enough to do that. And people were kind enough to show me how to do it. And I just followed what they told me to do.
I've got two follow-up questions. So the 90 units, so you built that ground up. That was your first deal?
Yeah, I'm still working on that, Ryan. So I also didn't know.
I don't know very many people who are just like, yeah, I'm just going to like not do this car dealership thing. And I'm just going to just go ground up on 90 doors.
I didn't, Ryan, I didn't know that that was a big deal. Like, I had no concept that that was a big deal. I didn't know that you were supposed to start with a single family home and then buy a duplex, and then you could get a fourplex, and then you trade up into maybe a small multifamily. And so it was really funny for me. It's shocking, actually, when I'd go to these meetups and people would ask, what are you doing? Oh, I'm working on entitlement for this 92-unit apartment complex in Mesa. How did you do that? And I said, I don't know. I just started doing it. I was learning, and still am learning on the fly. If I'd been really intelligent, I would have partnered with somebody that knew what they were doing and learned that way. The other part of that is I now know everything that you can possibly know about how to push an entitlement project through a city and what that requires. And that also means that I'll probably leave that part of development to somebody else and stick with the other side. That's a little quicker return.
Yeah. Now there's people listening to this, right? And they're hearing your good advice, right? Which is you don't have to start with a onesie, twosie trading up. You don't have to go slow and ramp up to bigger projects, right? Like you can go 90 or whatever, but they're going to go home and after listening to this, they're still not going to take the advice. They're still going to go think that you got to start small and work their way up, and they'll limit themselves into where they get started. Why do you think that is? Why do you think people outside of just hearing the advice, right? Because everybody hears this advice. I've heard other people, my first self-storage was a ground-up development with 755 units, which lots of units in storage is like not a big deal. We have like little cubbies and lockers and things like that. But I mean, a lot of people would be like, your first self-storage project was 120,000 square foot, ground-up development and difficult to entitle property. What are the clues, though, do you think on the difference in how you maybe would think that people would still decide to just stay small, play it safe, or whatever it might be?
I'll answer that for me, and then I can answer that, I think, generally. For me, that was natural. I had never been in the restaurant business when I started a restaurant. I saw a concept that I liked, and I thought I could do it better than what I saw. So I learned the concept, figured out how I could improve it, and then I did it, and I did it better. Same way with the car dealership. I learned the business. I saw where there could be improvements made, and then I did it better than what I learned. So for me, it just never occurred to me that that was a big deal. But I think generally speaking, that would apply to me also is I had never been in an environment where other people were doing anything of that size. When I finally got into networks, I thought that 92 units was a big deal until I joined this mastermind network. And part of that were a bunch of developers and everybody was sharing what they were doing. And they asked me to go first because I was new. And I was expecting like this jaw drop moment. Hey, that's so cool. and nobody batted an eye. And the next guy that shared was doing 1,000 units in downtown San Antonio. And I thought, wow, I'm in the right room. These guys are doing things that scare me, and I just need to learn from them, and then I can do the same thing that I've done my whole life. So I think the very first step and the most powerful step for me over the last few years was changing the rooms that I was in, being very intentional about, most of the time going to conferences and conventions, I had no clue what people were talking about. I was taking notes furiously. I'd go home and watch YouTube videos because I just didn't know. And then the next piece of advice that I didn't really take myself is I would try and find someone where I could bring some value and partner with them and learn how to do what they're doing. In my experience, most successful people are very willing to share what they're doing. And if you really can add value to what they're doing, they're willing to bring you on and teach you how to do it because they want you to be successful. Always, that they have an abundance mindset rather than a limiting mindset, which I think is at the heart of what your question is.
What is there something that happened in your upbringing, not to get personal, or in your life that made you become that way, where you're just, you know, thinking something that big is just not a big deal? Do you think there's a moment or a time that changed, or somebody that was in your life, or you're just born that way?
I just think I wasn't smart enough to recognize the danger, Ryan.
So you're the kid like jumping off the top of the roof and into the snowbank when you're growing up. You just got no fear. That's pretty much me.
We do have many stories of those, and my wife wonders how I survived to be an adult. That actually hits a really sensitive question that I was discussing with my grandmother last night, is that my dad passed away 3 years ago. One of the biggest regrets that I have is that there are a lot of questions that I never asked him. When I went to him at 21 years old and said, "Dad, I have this great idea. I've seen this restaurant. I've eaten there and I've taken a bunch of notes on what they're doing. I want to open one." He backed me. He supported me in doing that. And I don't know why.
Emotionally or financially?
Both. Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Financially, he put up the money. I never remember him saying, "I don't think you should do this. I think you should keep your job." And I wish I knew now why that was. Because if he had said, I think you should keep going to college and get a degree, that would have changed the entire trajectory of my life, but he didn't do that. Now, there were other people in my life that did that. I pitched the idea to my grandfather, and after the first pitch, he looked right at me and he said, "Alan, that'll never work." And I just thought he didn't understand that how it was going to work. So I re-explained it. And at the end of that, he says, "No, you don't understand. If you want to be successful in this life, you sell drugs, sex, or religion." And he just, I thought, "I'm going to be a failure."
or you inherit it, right? Like you inherit the money, right? That's the way. Did your dad take a lot of convincing, or was it just like, "Hey, Dad, I have this idea," and a couple of conversations? Or was he just like, "I'm all in, Alan, let's go"?
What was really funny is I'd spent months sitting in this restaurant taking notes. I'd park my car out behind the restaurant and watch food trucks come in and see where they were getting their food. I had done a ton of research. I had managed a franchise restaurant for about 6 months before that. So I had a really good concept of good systems and procedures that would improve it. The really funny thing is once I went to show that to him, he goes, "Oh, you know what? I think that's your mom's cousin's restaurant. We can just go talk to him and see how he did it." And it was right. I could have really just taken a shortcut if I had not been trying to sneak around and see what this idea was.
Learned it out of your own, though. I mean, I'm sure you saw things that he maybe didn't share in the perspective of, uncovering it, right?
And that's, well, yeah. And he never had the vision of doing more than one restaurant. From the beginning, we looked at this as an opportunity to do multiples. And, maybe it was my preparation that he liked. I'd like to think that you know, it was just blind faith in me. But the real answer is I don't know, because I never slowed down long enough to really ask him about that.
And how many years after that did he pass? Sorry, how many years after he said yes to that, backed you? Yeah.
Yeah, so... Well, so I opened the restaurant when I was 21 or 22, and I was 43 when he passed away. But from that time, we had, you know, not only did we grow to having five restaurants, but he brought in a partner and franchised it, and they did dozens of them all over the Western U.S. But then after that, we did, you know, he partnered with me in a car dealership and backed me in that, and you know, something really meaningful is after he passed away, my mom invested some of the money from his life insurance into this development project that I'm doing. And I was having a conversation with a friend and sharing some of these things. And he goes, you know, did it ever occur to you that your dad is still backing you? That he literally, the money from that your mom received from his passing, he is still backing you. He still believes in you. So, you know, that's been a real lesson to me, is I've really had to be careful. You know, if my 21-year-old son came to me and said, hey, Dad, I have this great idea. I want to open a flight school, or I want to, you know, would my first response be, well, let's see if the numbers are going to check out and let's see if it'll really work. And, or would I back him? And I hope the answer would be that I would have faith and trust and belief. And even if I didn't, that I would do everything I could to help him grow so he could become who he needs to be.
Yeah, but don't you think, you know, as dads, as a fellow dad, like, our job is to improve upon the, you know, our previous generations, right? So, like, you know, maybe your dad, and I'm not making assumptions, but, you know, I'm asking, you know, did your dad know how to assess the numbers, or did he just know how to assess the eye of the tiger, which is, you know, you as in your ability to get it done? And he knew that instinctively, perhaps. And now you've got all this education and perspective, right? So you're going to pass that criticism on with also the support, you know, instead of just saying what your grandfather said, which was, you know, go pound sand. It's never going to work, right? So I see progression there. I mean, I think you personally... you know, I think questioning your son's numbers and business plan and viability is all part of the progression of you guys becoming an awesome, you know, family. I mean, already being an awesome family, but making it even better. So, well, thanks for sharing.
What's really great as a follow-up on that, Ryan, is they've been watching what I've been doing with the fund that we've created and the development that we're doing in San Diego. And he flew with me out to San Diego about a month or so ago. I asked him to come help me with a meetup that we were sponsoring. And on the way back, we were flying my Bonanza. And he's going into flight school right now, so we're just having a good time flying back. And he was rear-ended in a car accident. And he's expecting a settlement. And he's like, well, Dad, I know I'm not an accredited investor, but could I give you that money? And could you put it into this project? And I'm like, well, yes and no, but let's just back up a little bit.
Technically, he's an employee of the fund, so he's an accredited investor, right?
Yeah. We could
there
treat
you go.
Him.
Yeah. what the rule says. Right?
But what I loved is that the light bulb went on. Right.
Yeah,
and he could see the vision, which wasn't a vision that I had at his age. And I am super excited for the path that he's on, because he wants to have a career in aviation, but he's already saying things like, you know I can live on X amount of dollars. I'm going to be making Y. I want to take that difference and be investing in deals like what you're doing or in other syndications. He's like, I would really like to be at a point where, you know, maybe by the time I'm 30 or something, I don't need to worry about flying anymore. I can still do it if I want to, but I will have spent, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years investing, and I'll be in a place where I have some other money coming in. And that to me is exciting. It's that progression that you talked about, Ryan, that is really, you know, it's exciting what I'm doing for myself, and it's going to be a great thing for my family. The 3 to 5 year vision is absolute. financial independence and lots of opportunities for doing good things because of that. But better than that is being able to have my kids watch this happen and learn from it and do something better than what I'm doing. That's what's really exciting.
Totally.
So, Alan, I want to kind of dial in there on the mindset piece, because, you know, I think as pilots, let's sort of equate this to airline pilots, and let's talk about the generational differences and you know, the older generation and the new generation coming up, and what's available out there in terms of education, you know, because, you know, you talked about how, you know, you worked really hard, and that I think is so reflective of how most airline pilots that are in their 50s and 60s grew up. It's like, you know, you went to flight school, you paid your dues for a decade. It was a hard industry.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes, you know, when you start talking about mindset and vision boards and financial freedom and financial independence, and I know if you're listening to this podcast, you're sort of on board, but there's, you know, certainly a lot of airline pilots out there, you know, people in the aviation industry who are like, this is smoke and mirrors and BS, and you know, you need to get out there and work hard and save your money. And I don't know, can you talk to you know, you said that you have a vision board, you and your family have a 3 and 5 year vision, that, you know, you're really focused on creating financial independence, and you know, I know that you're a member of GoBundance, and you're getting in these rooms with other people that are sort of that have seen the light. And so can you just talk about, you know, what it was like for you to sort of go from the old mindset of, you know, get a job, work hard, save money, fund your retirement accounts, to this sort of abundance mindset of like, oh my God, there's so much else out here and there's so much possibility.
Well, I think I had the mindset, but it was really tampered by, I felt like the path to that freedom was directly connected to hours of input, not that there could be an inverse relationship where you could actually work a lot less hours and make a lot more money. So that has been amazing. That shift is still happening. The vision boarding, I've read books like Think and Grow Rich and those things for most of my life. I just never applied any of it. It didn't stick. And that was primarily going back to, I didn't know anybody else who was doing it. And so that is the biggest shift, is now I had case studies of people who had been at the exact same place that I was, and they had either started 10 or 15 years ago or even just a few years ago, and they'd had these tremendous shifts in lifestyle and income because of the people that they were choosing to spend their time with. So, you know, to answer that question, I think what has changed is now I don't just look at what is the profitability potential, but also what input is required of me. If that input involves I have to get an office and work away from home, I don't know if I'm that interested in doing it now, because I know that I don't have to. And also recognizing that just there's so much potential in real estate that isn't just income related. It's, you know, I was sitting with a friend who's a pediatric heart surgeon who is facing, you know, like a $300,000 or $400,000 tax bill. And same mindset as you talked about, where he was working hard and trying to save money. And he was trying to figure out, he's got $1 million sitting in the bank, he's got this tax bill coming up, and he was trying to figure out how he could generate an extra $10,000 a month in passive income to improve his lifestyle. And he just didn't have any idea that he could literally go out and purchase one building. He could make one investment with the funds that he had sitting at 4 or 5% or whatever those were generating or not generating, he was already there. He could wipe out the tax burden, so he gets a $200,000 a year raise, and he could turn that into money that would almost replace what he's making as a doctor and cut his hours way back in order to have the lifestyle that he wanted. So the biggest thing is just being with other people who've already done it, who've already been there, and who are willing to show you how you can do it too. Because then you start believing it in yourself. And, you know, I can't claim to fully understand how a vision board changes your life so quickly. What I can tell you is I'd never done it before. 2023 was the first year that I'd written it down. I actually have four vision boards. I have one that's a 3 to 5 year vision. I have one that's this year, one that's this month, and then one every day that I keep that I decide in advance what my day is going to look like. On my 2023 vision board, there's only one thing that I wrote down at the beginning of this year that I haven't checked off yet, but I'm on track to do it. And when I wrote those things down, I thought they were impossible because it was income that was 4 or 5 times what I'd earned the previous year. It was health goals that seemed unattainable. It was unreal, but it's happened. And it just, I look at it every morning and I go to work trying to make it happen. You can change your life in a very short amount of time.
So true. That's so good. You know, it's easy to write off, this is like manifesting. It's like all BS, but it's pretty amazing. If you hold something in your mind, it's the reticular activation system in your mind where there's that joke that, you never notice how many ads there are for mattresses until you need a mattress, right? You never notice the other Jeeps on the road until you're driving a Jeep. And then it's like they're everywhere. And that's the reticular activation system in your mind. So if you hold something in it, your brain pays attention to those things. And they often, you'd be surprised how quickly something can come to fruition. So Ryan, I know you had a question that you wanted to jump
in. No, I just love to always go back to the origin. So, you have this moment and, you bump into this guy and he kind of talks about the power of real estate. How did you go into, how did you find these groups to go to? Like what was your very first group and exactly how did you find it? Was it just a Google search or how did you find that group?
Yeah, so the first group actually was somebody that I was going to church with. I didn't really know him very well. And I don't even know. I think we went to lunch or something or just get to know each other. And he actually was in the middle of doing his first syndication deal. It was like a 30-unit apartment complex. He was raising a little bit of money. And he invited me to a meetup. So I went there. That turned into, I love networking, getting to know people. So I'm a fish in water at those places. I'm very interested in other people's stories and their background and their history. So as I talked to those people, they would mention another meetup that was happening. And then somebody brought up, Bridger Pennington's fund launched live in Las Vegas. And I had no idea even really what that meant. But I left there going, oh, I can do that. That never was a thought that would have occurred before that. And, lo and behold, less than a year later, we've done it. And, going back to what we were talking about whether it's manifesting or whatever it is, you can believe what you want to believe there. But, I remember in flight school, they taught me never to fly the airplane where my brain hadn't already gone before. And I just feel like that's what I'm doing with my life is I'm pointing my brain where I want to go and before I fly my life there. And it somehow works out. Now, the stuff that I've got on my vision for this next year scare me to death because there's a really big part of me that thinks, okay, this worked once. I probably don't get 2 years in a row of this, but I'm excited to find out.
That's so good.
Yeah. And what advice would you give somebody who maybe doesn't have that credit for? Like if they were to try to find that spark meeting where, I understand that whole, you just get vectored into, you meet this person, you sort of upgrade, maybe that first meeting is kind of like a, for lack of better words, maybe a little rinky dink, like a local real estate, everybody's there just kind of flipping houses or whatever.
Actually, there was maybe 15 or 20 people there. It was a little room in a restaurant. Just about everybody in the room was trying to figure out how to do their first deal. I recognized that that probably wasn't the right room, but it also made me aware that, you know, I had never, again, I had been so head down and focused on my own business. I didn't know what meetup.com was. I didn't know that you could go and search, you know, pretty much any city in America right now. If you get on meetup.com or any other networking website, you can search for real estate meetup and find 10 of them that are going to happen this month somewhere close enough. And I don't think it really matters what room you start in. I think you might go to the right room the first time. You know, I joined Pace Morby's group on doing sub-2 transactions, learned a lot, realized it probably wasn't the direction that I wanted to go personally. Then I found GoBundance. That definitely was the right fit. You know, there's, I'm still in the same process. I just got an email from a guy I met last year. He's like, "Hey, are you going to this event that's in Scottsdale?" I had no clue even what he was talking about. I didn't know there was an event going on in Scottsdale, but now I'm going and I'm meeting him for dinner, you know, because the opportunity for the relationships and the education is something I can't pass up.
That's
talk,
so good.
Talk us through that 90 units. So you said it's almost finished. Is it framed? Is it leasing up? What's the kind of what's the status of that?
Well, the entitlement is almost finished. So,
oh, got it. Okay.
Again, yeah. Again, zero experience trying to do a major development that involves annexation into the city, rezoning part of the property, purchasing additional lots around it, and getting variances on from code to do exactly what you want to do. So I chose like level 10 difficulty for the number one project.
Totally. Yeah.
And
there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah. So I just had my first meeting where I took a member of the city council out to lunch to see if we can't get some political help with this. So I'm in that process of learning right now, but the finish line is, people will ask, you know, how's that project coming? I said, well, we've never been closer to being done.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what that means. I think we're a few months away from entitlement right now. We're really close.
Nice.
And, you know, and then I have to decide what happens from there. You know, my first choice is to sell it and move on to something that has, it's a little bit less labor intensive and a higher yield on my time and money. I'm also very curious to know, you know, with the right partnership, there's a great educational opportunity there, and I'm into the project pretty inexpensively. So, yeah, I'm just not trying to get that far ahead of myself. I want to get this step done, and then we'll evaluate what the options are from there.
Alan, how have you stepped away from your businesses? Because, you know, before, it sounds like about 4 years ago, you know, you had this epiphany. You realized, I'm working too hard and I want to focus on things that will create financial freedom, passive income. But how have you stepped away? Because if you were so busy before, how do you have the time now to work on this entitlement project and go to all these meetups?
Tate, I would love to say that was super successful. The reality is after losing those three people, I was wrecked emotionally, mentally. I would leave my house. I might be able to get an hour or two of work done, and I'd spend most of the rest of the day sleeping in the back of my truck at a state park. I was really ruined. I considered checking myself into like a mental health retreat for a month to try and get back. And so the answer, I built this great business. We had 30,000 followers on Facebook. We're doing $16 million a year in sales. I walked away from it. I told my partner if he would drop the paperwork, I would sign over my 60% ownership and just walk out. That's how desperate I was for healing at that time. So I didn't walk away with zero, but it also, I know now with the rooms that I'm in, that I left a lot of money on the table with that transaction. But at the time, the only thing that mattered was getting my mind healthy and not doing something to further hurt my family, which was a real scare for me at that time. And so, you know, I only had three things that I wanted then. I wanted to feel happy again. I wanted to feel prosperous again, and I wanted to know that my life had some kind of a purpose. And so, you know, I really spent most of 2021 seeking answers to those things. That was a lot of meditation. That was, that's actually when I started flying, and that changed everything for me. The sensation of flying, the having to focus my mind on flying, finding Angel Flight West and using this gift to help and serve others was totally life-changing. I literally owe my life to aviation. And so I've been given a second chance, and I'm trying to make the most out of that now, but it was not a glorious exit. So in some ways it was really easy because I didn't think too much about anything but how do I get out. And so I don't really have to worry about what's going to happen after I'm out.
Describe how flying provides that relief for you. I mean, what describe the sensation of what that does and how it relaxes you.
I will never forget my Discovery flight. And now this is coming from a kid who I went to air shows growing up. My grandpa, again, was a master sergeant based at Luke Air Force Base. I can remember him taking me and putting me in the cockpit of, you know, like an F-16. So I loved airplanes. I never allowed myself to go and fly. Part of that was maybe my own limiting beliefs. The other part was my wife's uncle had been killed in a small plane crash, so she wasn't excited about me flying. So that first Discovery flight, when we took off, it just felt to me, and I don't know that everybody has this, but to me, it felt like all of the problems that I was facing stayed on the ground. And I just soared. My spirit just soared. And then there was so much to learn. I didn't know anything about, you know, aerodynamics or the mechanics of an airplane or weather or the medical conditions that you have to know about, or pressurization or navigation, any of those things. So it gave my mind something to focus on that wasn't my problems. So that was a big deal. The other thing is, I think it just provides perspective. You know, you don't have to go very high. You get in a Cessna, you're not going to go very high anyway. So, but you get 3,000 or 4,000 feet above the ground, and all of a sudden you recognize that your life's kind of small and so are your problems. And then I would get up and you know, this is when I was starting to like try and find a single family house to flip or something. And I'd look and I'm like, man, look at that whole city of Phoenix right there. Like, there's so much opportunity out there. I'm not limited in what I can do. And so it was a shift in perspective. It was a real, I had to focus my mind somewhere else. So it was a real mental shift as well. And I think there's sometimes, there's just stuff that you're supposed to do with your life. And I walked in the door from that first Discovery flight without saying anything. My wife took one look at me and she said, oh, you found your thing today, didn't you? And it just lit me up.
That's so cool.
And I know that's not true. Maybe forever, you know, there may be people, it's just a job, and it's a great career. For me, I like to describe that period when I'd burned down that business and I was trying to figure out my life, that I was gainfully unemployed. So during that period of gainful unemployment, I spent just about every day at the airport. Right after that Discovery flight was in June, I closed on my first airplane in July and started flying. I bought another one a few months later and started renting it out. I bought a third one after I was licensed privately. And then, you know, I went all the way through being commercially rated, instrument rated, because I loved flying and I wanted to be as safe as possible doing it.
Do you think everybody should go take a Discovery flight and just try it?
I think everyone should take some kind of a Discovery experience. Now, for me, that was flying, but for somebody else, it might be scuba diving. I think everybody probably has that one thing in their mind that they've like always wanted to do, but they justify, I don't have the time to do it. I don't have the money to do it. I don't know anybody else who does it. So for me, yes, the answer, go fly an airplane. It'll change your life. But that, for somebody else, that might be playing the piano or scuba diving or you know, whatever it is that your heart's calling you to do. I feel like part of that too is what I'm doing now with Angel Flight West. I get to change the lives of people that are in desperate need of hope and healing, and give a gift that nobody else can provide except for the pilots that are flying with us. So I just feel like it was something I was called to do, but other people may have different callings.
Let me one more question on the love of aviation, right? And I love this stuff, by the way, because you know, the three of us on this call all have the bug. So we all have our different feelings, and you may have touched a nerve on how we feel, right? But, you know, kind of talk about, you know, you've flown in airplanes before, or you've been in the back of an airliner, or you've sat in the window and looked out, and you have the same perspective, maybe even a higher perspective at 35 or 40,000 feet. You know, what's the difference between, what's the difference in feeling between sitting in the back and sitting in the front and flying your own airplane?
Now, that's a great question, Ryan. I've never really even thought about that very much. For me, it's freedom. A lot of people are surprised by the fact that in a private airplane, you can take off. You don't have to tell anybody where you're going or what time you're going to be there or what route you're going to take. You probably should. Whether or not that's a requirement is between you and your wife. But for me, the absolute feeling of freedom that I get to choose what altitude I go. I get to choose how fast I go for the most part. I get to choose what route I take. I get to choose what airport I land at. I get to choose what I see along the way if I want to go straight there. Or, you know, I have a daughter that lives in Idaho. I've never flown the route to Idaho the same way because on the way there, I can see the Grand Canyon. I can see the Meteor Crater. I can see Lake Powell. I can fly over Zions. I can look at Park City. You know, like, so it's an adventure. And that's, for me, one of my core values is adventure. So it's an adventure every time I get in the airplane because I can choose it.
So if you're listening to this and you haven't taken a Discovery flight, I think you've got 5 reasons, maybe 10 reasons to just at least go just try it. You know, what's a Discovery flight these days? $500 and a couple hours of time. So go check it out. All right, Tate, I know you're dying to jump in here, so go for it.
Yeah. Well, I have to make the joke that airline pilots are very familiar with flying away from their problems.
Yeah.
But
totally. No. We just like to be above everybody else and look down on people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Pilots have been looking down on people since 1903. No, that's fantastic, Alan. I think that's just amazing. And you know what, I think your story is so inspiring. And I certainly feel so lucky that I get to do this as a career. I can certainly tell you that I love flying a whole lot more when I'm not doing it 17, 18 days out of the month. I think that's when it gets to become a job, you know? And so, you know, for me, the goal has always been freedom. And that's not freedom from the job, it's freedom to choose. It's like you just said, it's freedom to either go to work or not go to work. So, and I'm partners on a Bonanza as well. Love that thing. I just got to go fly it around for my birthday the other weekend. And man, if you haven't done, because I know a lot of pilots, you know, we're talking about Discovery flies, but most of the listener group are you're probably sitting in the cockpit right now listening to this. If you haven't gone and flown GA recently, totally. Get back in a small airplane. It is so much fun.
Totally. It reinvigorated my love for it. I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, we live in the Pacific Northwest, so it's even easier to, you know, love what you do here. I mean, you can save time and go to cool places here. So,
well, I want to hear a little bit more about Angel Flight West. I know we're running short on time, but, you know, for me, when I think about, you know, there's, if you haven't heard of them, there's 5 freedoms, right? It's financial freedom, time freedom, location freedom. Location freedom is an easy one for airline pilots, right? We get to jump seat all over the world for free. But then there's relationships and impact. And I feel like it's almost like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's like, you know, you come up through the rankings of those freedoms until you get to the very top where it's like, hey, I've got all the financial and time and location freedom that I need. And once people tend to satisfy all of those sort of personal needs, it becomes, okay, how can I turn around and help others? And so I'd love to hear a little bit more about Angel Flight West and your experience with them and what you do for them.
And I would actually challenge that idea a little bit, Tate. I would, only because I've experienced it. So when I joined Angel Flight West, I didn't have an income. I had some money in the bank and some resources, but I didn't have income. But I found something that inspired me to do something bigger and better than I was. And you've probably read it. If not, I'd recommend it, The Go-Giver. I read that book during this time period and recognized that I think I had been trying to approach life that way reservedly, but now it's unabashedly. I did, in 2022, I did 1,000 hours of either public outreach or flying for Angel Flight West. Most of that was public outreach and networking and marketing for them because I loved it. They didn't pay me anything, but it did create relationships that have led to partnerships and opportunities because I was showing up to give something away, not to get something. So I think if you can connect with the giving part in your life at a much earlier phase and get very generous there, that it will impact and influence every other part of your life. Angel Flight West is a nonprofit that was started 40 years ago. There were a couple of guys at the Santa Monica Airport that were flying for $100 hamburgers together. And I don't know what sparked the conversation, but they asked themselves the question, hey, you know, we're kind of every weekend we're going and we're doing this thing, but you know, maybe there's something better that we could be doing with our airplanes. And so what they started doing is they started providing free flights for people who needed medical care far from home. And now Angel Flight West has been in operation for 40 years. We just completed our 100,000th mission. Our pilots, we've got 2,000 pilots in 13 Western states. They donate their time, their aircraft, the cost of the fuel, the entire cost of the flight to help people get the care that they need. My first flight changed my life. I flew to Lake Havasu and picked up a young man whose name is Bradley. Bradley was 15 when he was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. And his mom would drive him 5.5 or 6 hours to Phoenix Children's Hospital 3 times a week. You can imagine having to get up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to get your son to his cancer appointment. You spend 5.5 or 6 hours on the road, then you're at the hospital all the way, and then you turn around and drive back because you've got 2 other kids there to take care of. What kind of a detrimental impact that will have financially on a family, emotionally on a family, physically on the family. And you know, the flight, my bonanza to Lake Havasu is just a little over an hour. And so I could pick up Bradley and get him to the Deer Valley Airport, where one of our other volunteers would pick him up and get him to the hospital at zero cost to his family. They didn't have to get up early. They're not spending all the time on the road. And so you solve 2 really big challenges for people. You solve the barrier of cost for healthcare, and you solve the barrier of the logistics of getting healthcare that they need. I'll tell you about another flight that changed my life that I didn't do. I was invited to participate in the pediatric care committee for Yuma Regional Medical Center and share with them what Angel Flight could do. Yuma's about 4 hours from Phoenix. And there was a lady in that meeting, her name is Stacy. And after I had shared, she said, Alan, I wish we had known about Angel Flight West. It might have made a difference. And she then shared her story. Her daughter was born with a congenital heart defect in February of 21. She got sick. They thought it was the flu. And they scheduled an appointment with her doctor in Phoenix, and they started the trip. They made it halfway to Dateland, and then Addie was the daughter's name, squeezed her mom's hand, and she passed away on the side of the road. And, you know, I'm a business guy, And up until that point, my vision for my involvement with Angel Flight West was I'm going to double the number of flights. I'm going to double the number of pilots. It was all about the numbers. I realized there that that's not really the real impact of what anybody does who's giving. And it doesn't have to be Angel Flight West. It could be any other charity that you're supporting that helps others in need. But all I needed to really to do was make sure that I was never sitting in front of another mom who said, I wish I would have known. I don't want another, you know, young girl making it halfway to the care that she needs. And so our pilots change people's lives doing that. So we do non-emergency medical flights. Also, if somebody's receiving treatment and there's a family member that wants to be with them, we can fly those family members back and forth. We do free flights for active duty military personnel and for veterans. We do flights for victims of domestic violence and abuse so that they can get far away from the people who are harming them. And we also fly other charitable missions. One that's coming up that's fun is our pilots during Christmas time donate, or we adopt some of the families that we do flights for and provide Christmas for them. So, you know, last year I did this with some pilots. This year again, we just met and we'll all put Santa hats on and our headset on and throw a bunch of stuff in the Bonanza and the Cirrus that the other guys fly, whatever, and fly these up to these ones happen to be on the Navajo reservation, but we'll fly up there and provide Christmas for a family of six whose five-year-old is traveling to Colorado for cancer treatment. And so here's what that does for me is I tell people now I don't have bad days. You know, yeah, my five-year-old daughter isn't fighting cancer. I don't have a daughter that was born with a congenital heart defect who's traveling back and forth to Phoenix for care. You know, it just adds so much perspective. It puts the rest of my life and challenges into a very, very clear perspective for me. And it allows me to do something that really impacts not only that person's lives, but their family's life, their caregiver's life. It's such a rewarding feeling. It motivates everything that I do.
That's amazing.
That's great.
Thanks for sharing, Alan.
Yeah, this was a great episode, and I really appreciate you getting a little vulnerable and going deep on some of the things that you do and care for. Really learned a lot about you. You know, we want to be respectful of your time, and how can listeners get in touch with you, maybe learn a little bit more about what you're doing in San Diego? What would you like to leave for your contact information?
Well, I'm pretty easy to get a hold of. You can find me on social media. The Alan Underwood, I think, is what I am on LinkedIn. My email is Alan, A-L-A-N, at mmtmgrp.com. That would get you in touch with me there. I'm also, and I know Tate, you and I just talked about this the other day, I'm a few weeks away from starting my own podcast called Plain Success, where, you know, yeah, where I want to talk to entrepreneurs and pilots who, you know, I like the tagline thing is like titans of industry and aces of aviation. And I'm just excited to have conversations with other aviators. And, you know, I like what you, Ryan and Tate, are doing. I see you guys as down the trail from me. And I think, man, that looks pretty cool. I'm going to see if we can't accomplish that and do some good things in the world like those guys are doing.
It's incredible. Well, we'll link to that in the show notes. Thank you so much, Alan. We'll definitely have a follow-up conversation at some point. We appreciate you coming on and sharing.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you.
Take care.